This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about this piece that that I read in this past Sunday's New York Times Magazine, right? And it's, you know, it basically addresses the whole issue of toxic masculinity, but not so much going into, you know, the details of toxic masculinity, but like questioning whether or not it's a meaningful phrase, right? So the author was Lauren Euler, and what she says of toxic masculinity as she reads it is that it describes the strict gender norms that encourage men to repress their emotions and exhibit dominance to the point of aggression. And she has a problem with the ways in which toxic masculinity is used. And as a sociologist, I kind of feel like there are a few things that she says about it that I found fascinating. Not that I necessarily agreed with them, but I found her analysis fascinating, right? The confidence with which these complex phenomena are blamed on a single systemic agent, like i.e. toxic masculinity, it's not unique to debates about women's rights. The image conjured when we use this is one of a passive population, helpless to defend ourselves against the invisible but deadly ideological forces that surround us, corrupting our purity and then turning us into agents of our own destruction. And another critique that she has of it that I also found interesting, she said that, where is this? Yeah, that basically toxic masculinity, I'm paraphrasing, concentrates structural criticism in the symptom, not the cause, suggesting a little cleanup will suffice. So I found this article to be very interesting, especially in light of the past month that we've endured with the Kavanaugh. With the whole sort of Kavanaugh fiasco. So I was wondering what you all thought.
Can you explain this to me a little better? So it's a criticism against the concept of toxic masculinity.
Yes.
Because she sees it as a symptom of a deeper problem, which is what?
Yeah. So it seems to me that number one, right, it's not the cause of our problems. It's the symptom of a problem, right? Number one. And number two, I think part of what she's arguing is that that toxic masculinity is often targeted at an individual, right? Like the toxic masculinity resides in this individual, right? And that is used to, you know, either excuse their behavior, right? Or to just sort of focus, you know, the individual as being sort of the cause of all of the bad things that are associated with toxic masculinity, as opposed to saying, well, hey, if there is this thing called toxic masculinity, right, is it really just residing in that individual, right? And even if it is, what is the cause of this, right? And until we start using toxic masculinity, right, in better ways, right, in ways that I think part of what she's saying is, you know what I mean? Don't use it as an excuse. Don't say structure is the excuse, but actually looking at what is actually embedded in our structures and our systems and try and figure out what the root of this toxic masculinity is. Now, I should actually point out that, you know, she's not coming at this as an academic, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought it was interesting because I'm an academic reading a non-academic take on toxic masculinity.
Yeah, I'm glad you explained it to me, because when I read it, I couldn't tell if it was I just thought it was an incoherent argument. Mm-hmm. And now you're saying that it's a critique of an argument as being incoherent.
Yes.
I think there's a third possibility, which is an incoherent critique of an incoherent argument.
Well, I mean, so I may, like, I'm sure I gave it a bit of a generous read, in part because I will say that the whole past 2 weeks, right, has filled me with quite a bit of rage, right? Mm-hmm. And if I were just sitting down writing about this, right, I might be a bit incoherent as well.
Well, let's talk about coherency, though, because that's kind of what the Sokol Squared people were dinging us with. Is toxic masculinity, is it a well-formed, well-defined concept that is based on sad research, or is it part of what they call grievance studies, where they're just broad labels attached to status groups that people might harbor animus towards?
It feels like a vague concept to me. That's the funny thing is that we don't really use concepts like that in sociology, even though if you ask your grandma, she'd say that we do. But it strikes me as a pretty vague concept. I mean, I kind of have an idea of what it means, and I think it has, like, at its core, kind of a meaningful concept. And I'll talk a little bit about how later about, you know, where I think it's useful to distinguish different aspects of masculinity. But like, in the ways that I thought it was incoherent is, like, this dig at Scott Pruitt, mm-hmm. where, you know, that is just a pun, but it's a pun at the expense of a point, where she basically says, like, oh, he was a toxic boss, and ironically, he was promoting toxic water. And it's like, okay, that's just a pun on the word toxic. Mm. But, and it's like, A, he was, you know, not exactly on the ball when it came to, you know,
not being corrupt,
you know, parts per million or whatever. And also he does seem like an epically terrible boss, but it's like, was he a terrible boss in a distinctly masculine way? Like, I don't think so. Like, when I've read about Scott Pruitt, he sounds like a really bad version of, what's that Anne Hathaway movie?
A Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It sounds like, you know, the Devil Wears Prada for men.
Yeah, no. So Gabriel, yeah. So that wasn't her point there at all. She's interrogating the use of the word toxic, period, right? As a signifier. So toxic boss, right? It's funny because actually he was literally in charge of this thing that increased the toxicity in drinking water. I mean, she goes on, she goes through and she interrogates, the origins of the word toxic. And she talks about the modern use of the word toxic, right? Yeah. And she does that without using it as, you know, a modifier of masculinity. So that actually might be where some of the sort of confusion is throughout. She's not specifically talking about toxic masculinity. She's interrogating the use of the word toxic, period. Right. And part of me actually, you know, was thinking, I think that there are actually some gender theorists out there that would say toxic masculinity is kind of redundant, right?
Oh, like all masculinity is toxic?
Well, yeah, like masculinity is not a good thing, right? It might, and it's masculinity in and of itself, or more broadly, strict like gender norms themselves, right? That are unhealthy.
Yeah, so, I mean, here's where I wanted to get to with like different dimensions of it. I mean, to the extent that I think there's anything to this concept at all, I think you kind of have to distinguish it. And so I'm a big fan of the Norwegian novel Kristin Lavransdatter, and it's about the titular character is Kristin, who's a woman, and it mm-hmm. covers basically her entire life. But the two big male figures in her life are her father Lavrans, who's kind of the perfect dad, and Erland, her husband, who's like, you know, one of the great bad boys of literature. And, you know, like one of the first dates, he's basically like, you know, I'm no good for you, Kristin, you know? So, and actually a friend of mine who was reading the book with me, she texted me and she's like, oh my God, this fucking guy, you know, with that passage where he's like, you know, I'm no good for you, Kristin. So, you know, but the funny thing about it is that both Lavrans and Erland are intensely masculine. They're just masculine in different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, Lavran is like a total dad, and Erland is like the total bad boy. But neither of them really does it. You know, Lavrans would never in a million years womanize. And Erland would, you know, was not a good father and or a good husband. But both of them were highly masculine. Neither of them were wusses.
Hmm.
I guess I shouldn't make metaphors based on novels you guys haven't read.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah. No, it's fine. I mean, I think it brings up the whole notion of what is it we mean when we talk about this thing called masculinity, mm-hmm. right? You know, and is there one hegemonic masculinity, right? I guess it depends on the context. But this notion of toxic masculinity, at least in the way that it's crept into sort of kind of like mainstream audiences and the media. And I think in particular, although she doesn't focus on it, like this is the way kind of she introduces the use of the phrase is in, you know, blaming toxic masculinity for sexual assault and sexual harassment, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, so I want to bring in another non-academic New York Times author who talks about masculinity, which is Ross Douthat has been talking for a while mm-hmm. about this idea that there's like, you know, we saw this shift in the 1960s where, you know, there's a notion of patriarchy and masculinity and all that sort of thing, but it's kind of an ambiguous concept. And he likes to point out that there's really two aspects to it. There's the kind of dad style and then like the playboy style. And he sometimes refers to the latter as Hefnerism mm-hmm. as if it was like, you know, an explicit ideology, which in some ways it is. And, you know, he likes to point out that you kind of have like, if you imagine like Hugh Hefner, and then you have like, you know, your classic, like somewhat patriarchal, but like dad type, like, you know, Mitt Romney or something. And then you have on the third part, you have notions that are skeptical of masculinity and, you know, basically feminism. There's this weird thing where it's like this triangular system where one side can't always tell the difference between the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And also, to the extent they can tell, they'll kind of strategically ally because none of the three really wants any of the other three to win.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.